Confederates in the Attic by Tony Horwitz. Copyright 1998 by Tony Horwitz. This recording of the full-length reading of Confederates in the Attic was published by arrangement with Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing, a division of Bantam Doubleday Dell Publishing Group, Incorporated, and was produced in 1999 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright there, too. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape, Incorporated. This book is read by Arthur Addison. Chapter 1. Confederates in the Attic. There never will be anything more interesting in America than that Civil War, never. Gertrude Stein. In 1965, a century after Appomattox, the Civil War began for me at a musty apartment in New Haven, Connecticut. My great-grandfather held a magnifying glass to his spectacles and studied an enormous book spread open on the rug. Peering over his shoulder, I saw pen-and-ink soldiers hurtling up at me with bayonets. I was 6, Papa Isaac, 101. Egg-bald, barely 5 feet tall, Papa Isaac lived so frugally that he sliced cigarettes in half before smoking them. An elderly relative later told me that Papa Isaac bought the book of Civil War sketches soon after emigrating to America in 1882. He often shared it with his children and grandchildren before I came along. Years later, I realized what was odd about this one vivid memory of my great-grandfather. Isaac Moses Persky fled Tsarist Russia as a teenaged draft dodger, in Yiddish, a shirker, and arrived at Ellis Island without money or English or family. He worked at a Lower East Side sweatshop and lived literally on peanuts, which were cheap, filling, and nutritious. Why, I wondered, had this thrifty refugee chosen as one of his first purchases in America a book written in a language he could barely understand, about a war in a land he barely knew, a book that he kept poring over until his death at 102. By the time Papa Isaac died, my father had begun reading aloud to me each night from a 10-volume collection called The Photographic History of the Civil War. Published in 1911, the volume's ripe prose sounded as foreign to me as the captions of my great-grandfather's book must have seemed to him. So, like Papa Isaac, I lost myself in the pictures, sepia men leading sepia horses across cornfields and creeks, jaunty volunteers, their faces framed by squished caps and fire-hazard beards, barefoot Confederates sprawled in trench mud, eyes open, limbs twisted like licorice. For me, the fantastical creatures of Maurice Sendak held little magic compared to the man-boys of Matthew Brady, who stared back across the centuries separating their lives from mine. Before long, I began to read aloud with my father, chanting the strange and wondrous rivers, Shenandoah, Rappahannock, Chickahominy, and wrapping my tongue around the risible names of rebel generals, Braxton Bragg, Jubal Early, John Sappington Marmaduke, William Extra Billy Smith, Pierre Gustave Touton Beauregard. I learned about palindromes from the Southern Sea Captain Raphael Semmes, and I began to match Brady's still deaths with the curt stutter of farm roads and rocks that formed the photographer's backdrop. Mule Shoe, Slaughter Pen, Bloody Lane, Devil's Den. In third grade, I penciled a highly derivative Civil War history of my own. The war was started when, after all the states had seceded, it began, and embarked on an ambitious art project, painting the walls of our attic with a lurid narrative of the conflict. Preferring underdogs, I posted a life-sized Johnny Reb by the bathroom door. A pharaonic frieze of rebel soldiers at Antietam stretched from the stairs to the attic window. Albert Sidney Johnston's death at Shiloh splashed across an entire wall. General Pickett and his men charged bravely into the eaves. I'd reached the summer of 1863 and run out of wall. But standing in the middle of the attic, I could whirl and whirl and make myself dizzy with my own cyclorama. The attic became my bedroom, and the murals inhabited my boyhood dreaming. And each morning I woke to a comforting sound. My father bounding up the attic steps, blowing a mock bugle call through his fingers and shouting, "General, the troops await your command." 25 years later, the murals were still there, and so was my boyhood obsession. I'd just returned to America after 9 years abroad and moved to an old house in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains. My Australian wife chose the spot. The fields and cows and crooked fences fit Geraldine's image of outback America. For me, the place stirred something else. I stared at a brick church, still bullet-scarred from a Civil War skirmish. In the lumpy village graveyard, I found Confederates and Yankees buried side by side, some of them kin to each other. Within an hour of our new home lay several of the battlegrounds I'd painted as a child, and to which I now dragged Geraldine on weekend drives. At a picnic soon after our arrival, I overheard a neighbor ask Geraldine how she liked Virginia. "Fine," she sighed, "except that my husband's become a Civil War bore." I'd always been one, of course, but my obsession had lain dormant for several decades. With adolescence had come other passions, and I'd stuffed my toy musket, plastic rebel soldiers, and Lincoln logs into a closet reserved for boyish things. A Dayglow poster of Jimi Hendrix supplanted Johnny Reb. Pickett's Charge and Antietam Creek vanished behind dartboards, Star Trek posters, and steep drifts of teenage clutter. But a curious thing had happened while I'd lived abroad. Millions of Americans caught my childhood bug. Ken Burns's TV documentary on the Civil War riveted the nation for weeks. Glory and Gettysburg played to packed movie houses. The number of books on the Civil War passed 60,000. A bibliography of works on Gettysburg alone ran to 277 pages. On the face of it, this fad seemed out of character for America. Like most returning expatriates, I found my native country new and strange, and few things felt stranger than America's amnesia about its past. During the previous decade, I'd worked as a foreign correspondent in lands where memories were elephantine. Bosnia, Iraq, Northern Ireland, Aboriginal Australia. Serbs spoke bitterly of their defeat by Muslim armies at Kosovo as though the battle had occurred yesterday, not in 1389. Protestants in Belfast referred fondly to King Billy, as if he were a family friend rather than the English monarch who led Orangemen to victory in 1690. Returning to America, I found the background I lacked wasn't historical, it was pop cultural. People kept referring to TV shows I'd missed while abroad, or to athletes and music stars I'd never seen perform. In the newspaper, I read a government survey showing that 93% of American students couldn't identify an important event in Philadelphia in 1776. Most parents also flunked. 73% of adults didn't know what event D-Day referred to. Yet Americans remained obsessed with the Civil War. Nor was this passion confined to books and movies. Fights kept erupting over displays of the rebel flag, over the relevancy of states' rights, over a statue of Arthur Ashe slated to go up beside Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson in Richmond. Soon after my return, the Walt Disney Company unveiled plans for a Civil War theme park beside the Manassas battlefield. This provoked howls of protest that Disney would vulgarize history and sully the nation's hallowed ground. It seemed as though the black and white photographs I'd studied as a child had blurred together, forming a Rorschach blot in which Americans now saw all sorts of unresolved strife over race, sovereignty, the sanctity of historical landscapes, and who should interpret the past. Then, early one morning, the Civil War crashed into my bedroom. A loud popping noise crackled just outside our window. "Is that what I think it is?" Geraldine asked, bolting awake. We'd sometimes heard gunfire while working in the Middle East, but it was the last sound we expected here, in a hamlet of 250, where bleeding sheep had been our reveille for the past 6 months. I went to the window and saw men in gray uniforms firing.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?